is Renaeus Radio for the Seeker.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Henrik here, and it's good to talk to you again. Hope you had a good week. The website is redicecreations.com. News from around the world, and we have tons of in-depth interviews available on our website with tons of different topics. Today, we're talking with Stephen Mailer, an independent Egyptologist who wrote The Land of Osiris, a book that tries to answer the questions surrounding the advanced prehistoric civilization in ancient Egypt, or Kemet. And we're going to discuss how this civilization, and in the extension, ours, has transformed from light into darkness. And welcome back, Stephen Mailer. Thank you for coming on with us here at Red Eyes Radio again. We enjoyed having you with us for that roundtable a few months ago. There's been much more to your work, of course, so we're looking forward to spending some of your time talking about this today. By the way, I hope the tour went well also.
Thank you, Henrik. It did very well, and I'm very glad to be able to speak to you and the audience today, because it was that roundtable interview that you did with all of us that enabled us to get a bunch of group of people that came. We actually had a Red Ice group with us on tour, so
awesome.
We were very pleased.
Yes. Thank you for everyone who took the time and attended, and I hope you had a good time as well. Thanks, guys.
They did, and they were great and typical of your type of audience. Were very well informed and were great members of the tour.
Excellent. Very glad to hear that. New stuff found out. I heard some things you managed to piece together on this tour. And of course, as we talked about it, access to some of the sites was a big advantage, I guess, as well this time, right?
Yes. This was the 14th tour I've done in the last 20 years, but far and away, this was the best. We have now access to sites that we have not taken tour groups before, a place like the Serapeum, which we can discuss in detail, and so-called Middle Kingdom pyramid sites, which we took everybody to. It was great. Everything went well. There was no problems for us. The only situation was, of course, we were sometimes the only tourists at the site. So I would tell the group, good for you, bad for Egypt, because they're really hurting for tourism. But we had site totally access to ourselves, so it was maximum exposure for the folks that came with us.
Very good. Elizabeth just linked up on the website, our website, about some looting going on in Egypt right now. Some of the, you know, heritage sites, some folks down there are talking about like 70% of certain sites being gone. You know, they call it sneak diggings and everything else. Have you heard about this at all, Stephen?
Yes, it's happening, but I'm afraid that's a little overexposed and a little overreported. This is something that has gone on in Egypt for many, many years, the illegal antiquities gathering and looting, etc. It has increased since the revolution, there's no doubt. And it is going on, but it's not that sites are being closed down and that the sites are being totally excavated of artifacts. It's not happening. Again, this type of thing has happened before. It happened after the revolution, and right now Egypt is in a tense situation, particularly today. And so these things are going on, but it's being overreported by the press. It's not as bad as people making out, and we had no problem at our site. Again, accessing all that we wanted to do, there was no problems and there was no interference.
I'm not surprised by that. It's a kind of a, well, again, not that it's a no story, but it's usually the press usually kind of exaggerates when their position, when they should be able to downplay it, and then the reverse, if there is actually something serious going on, they're not reporting on that. So it's kind of funny how that works.
Well, it is a strange thing. A couple, you know, the Western countries, the U.S. in particular, Canada, Australia now, surprisingly, are putting out a lot of bad press about Egypt. They're over-accentuating what's happening there, telling their people it's not safe to go. And, you know, one of the reasons we came on with you before and why I'm here today is tell people that Egypt is safe, no matter what they're reading, what's going on today. The tourists are not getting bothered. This is something that's happening between the Egyptian people. Again, none of our group was ever harassed at any of the sites. There was never any danger for anyone in our group. There is no danger. Egypt needs tourism. And so we're letting people know The sites are safe. There's a whole bunch of tours that are scheduled by the Kemet School, which we'll talk about, the website and everything, for this fall. And I would advise everyone to please go and don't be scared off by press rumors, because Egypt is safe.
Very good. So what did you guys learn about the Serapeum? Let's talk about that a little bit, and maybe you can remind us about some of the stuff that we talked about last time. This just incredible site with obvious signs of technology, advanced technology being used to cut some of these major stones and everything. Were you guys actually down there this time then? Did you manage to go down into it?
Yes, sir, we did. We actually spent 2 hours in the Serapeum, which actually an hour and a half, close to 2 hours, which seemed like 20 minutes because of the energy down there.
Yeah.
And this was the first time taking a whole group, which was amazing. And again, because of you, because of people who listened on Red Eyes, people who came with Brian Foster and with Chris Dunn, there were a bunch of engineers with us. So this was great to have that feedback by people who have some of the technical expertise to understand what we're seeing. For people who don't know, the Serapeum is an underground series of tunnels, underground, drilled straight in the limestone bedrock underneath the site of Saqqara. There are a bunch of tunnels where there are niches. In these niches are stone boxes. These incredible boxes that are made out of gray granite, black granite, rose granite, of basalt, and only one of limestone. And what we see, again, this is what Chris Dunn calls the ultimate smoking gun. The precision and the tolerance we see in these boxes cannot be explained by any other than the most advanced means of technology and engineering. We see tolerances of 2/10,000 of an inch, surfaces that are, I would say, smooth as glass, but they're smoother than glass. I mean, perfect right angles, perfect. And these boxes weigh an average of 70 to 100 tons with lids attached to them.
Wow.
And what we discovered this time, which I'm convinced of, is that what we're seeing is only a small part of what this complex is. These underground tunnels might go for many, many more miles. And there may be dozens, if not 50 more, of these kind of boxes. And we can discuss what we think the purpose was them for. But what, you know, Egyptology has told us is that the only thing these boxes could have been for is that there was a cult of bulls, a bull cult, sacred bull called the Apis bull, and when the bull died, they would make a big deal about mummifying the bull, and then put him in these sarcophagus and have these ceremonies, which is what they tend to want us to believe. Only there's no evidence to back this whatsoever. There's never been a bull mummy ever found in any of these boxes. There's never been anything found in any of these boxes. There was in the 1840s when the first Egyptologist, modern time Egyptologist, Auguste Mariette, entered this site. He found a mummified head of a bull in the corridor, never in one of the boxes. So, and then they found next to this site a cache of bull bones. So there was this cult. So it led them to believe that that's what these boxes were made for. But there's no evidence that any bull was ever found in there, ever interred in there. And we are completely convinced, I am certainly, that these boxes are pre-dynastic, that they were not made by dynastic people for any type of ritual cult, that they served some type of energetic purpose to amplify acoustic sound energy at the site.
Wow. It's Saqqara is on the opposite side. No, wait, remind me about where it is in location to the Giza Plateau.
You're absolutely right. As if you're going by the Nile, Giza is on the east side of the Nile, and Saqqara is on the west side. Actually, Giza is on the west side of the Nile, too, now. But Saqqara is on the west side of the Nile today. This is why it was originally, the site was named after a netter called Saqqar, which was a falcon-type deity, which was a ruler of the west. The west was the area that dead went to. So during dynastic times, even going back to what we call the Old Kingdom period, maybe far back as 3000 BCE, they started using the site as a burial site. So it has, it is a necropoli, a necropolis, the word in Greek, meaning where the dead are buried. There are many, many, many dynasties, many, many thousands of years of cemeteries here. They'll never find, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, they could be excavating here for another 100 years, and they'll never find all the tombs that are there. But it is our contention, based on the work of my master teacher, Abdel Hakim Aoyan, who we'll discuss more if you'd like, who taught us that originally these sites were on the east side of the Nile. The original Nile is what we call the Ur-Nil, or it's now today the Western Desert, which is completely dried up. This is all documented in my first book, Land of Osiris. The original was a huge river in the west, and this site, today called Saqqara, was on the east side of that Nile and would have been a living site. So originally, Saqqara wasn't called Saqqara. It was called Buwizer, which means Land of Osiris, part of the complex I talk about in my first book, of sites from Dashur in the south, Abu Wash in the north, 25 square miles, which includes Giza and Saqqara, all characterized by having stone masonry pyramids and very ancient temples. And on a grid line, this was an ancient grid line. So Saqqara originally would have been not called Saqqara, it would have been just part of the land of Osiris, and it was an active living site for healing. So we believe these boxes, these underground boxes, were involved in the sound energy that was produced, in the free energy that we believe was produced on the land of Osiris site, and these boxes were there to greatly amplify the sound. I characterize, like Christopher Dunn has characterized the Great Pyramid as a power plant, I characterize the Serapeum as a power station.
What kind of energy, or not what kind of energy, but what amounts do you think we're talking about, and what were they powering?
Well, that is a great question. You know, there can only be speculation at this point, but it seems like there's tremendous amounts of energy produced. Like, if we just go by the Great Pyramid alone, we can calculate that it produces microwaves, produces radio waves, produces hydrogen gas, produced quantum waves, all types of electromagnetism. So, and in fact, energy that we perhaps cannot even document. So we're talking about tremendous amounts of free energy. We're using here a basis of acoustic resonance, that the pyramids, these temples, were tuned to different frequencies of sound. Why we talk about the particular stone that has been documented, and it's a wonderful thing now, but Yusuf Arayan, who you spoke to in our group interview last year, who is Hakim's second youngest son and is now the co-director of the Kemet School of Ancient Mysticism with his wife, Patricia Arayan, Yusuf has now characterized 10 distinct types of stone that the ancient people used. Incredible amount of documentation. And they chose the hardest stones there are on our planet. Granite, rose granite, which we have documented the rose granite used by the ancient Egyptians to be anywhere between 40 to 55% rose quartz crystal. So they chose the stone for its crystalline content, not because of its hardness. Hardness didn't mean anything to them. They had obviously no problem working with the hardest materials that have ever been on this planet with relative ease. But they chose the stone for its crystalline content, because of its vibratory content, because of the use of it for harmonic resonance, that these stones were vibrating in harmonic resonance from the pyramids, from these temples, from these underground chambers, and with water rushing through the site, and combining with the crystal, produced tremendous amounts of electromagnetism and the different types of acoustic resonance. We believe that's what set the Great Pyramid into harmony, was its resonance. And this is what gives people the spiritual quality they have today. We go into the Great Pyramid, like with our group, we had the pyramid for 2 hours to ourselves. We had all three chambers of the Great Pyramid open, which has never happened before that I've been inside the Great Pyramid, including the subterranean chamber, mm-hmm. the queen's chamber, and the so-called king's chamber, and all our group got to go in there. Brian Foster actually took video down in the sub-chamber, which is going to be amazing
nice.
To see. Yes. So we had it all open to us, and people still have that spiritual experience. And we go in there, Gary Evans is a master at this understanding of toning, of using sound, of using sound in resonance to raise one's own consciousness. Gary led us in toning in the Great Pyramid, and everybody has an experience. Why? Because the pyramid is still vibrating. It is still vibrating and producing infrasound, and it is that infrasound which causes us to have that spiritual effect that people have when they go into the Great Pyramid. So it's still producing sound today, no longer a functioning power plant. We can discuss how that ended, because that's key to our major discussion, but still produces infrasound, still a coupled oscillator, like Chris Dunn talks about. A coupled oscillator is a device that is vibrating in harmonic resonance with an already vibrating source.
Mm-hmm.
The already vibrating source that the Great Pyramid resonates to is the Earth itself, the Schumann resonance. So the Great Pyramid is a function, is a harmonic of the Schumann resonance still today.
So if the power plant is not functioning at full capacity anymore, the vibratory properties that you've been mentioning in terms of the acoustics and everything else, is that also kind of working on half capacity, or is it still just 100% exactly as it was originally? What do you think?
No, that's a great question. I would say, I couldn't put a number on it, but not full capacity, no. To have the maximum effect, of course, the pyramid would have had it been fully functioning. All the pyramids would be vibrating in resonance. The water would still be actively flowing. There is still water flowing under the Giza Plateau. It's very interesting. I used to tell people before, when Zaki Hawass was in power from the early 80s to 2011 when he was deposed, he was constantly having projects of pumping water out of the Giza Plateau. Every time people would come there, there'd be these great pumps, and they'd be pumping water out. And of course, people would go, oh, he's just trying to find tombs. He's just trying to find evidence. Well, he was, but it was continually trying to get the water out so they could get down there, and they never were able to get it all out. So the water still is coming in, so it's still functioning that way. But as your question said, to be 100%, it would have been 100% still functioning, full total grid system, meaning from Upper Washington North to Dashore in the South, with the water in residence. It's not, hasn't been doing that for over 10,000 years, so it's not producing the effect. No, I 50%, 60%, I couldn't put a number on it, but it's certainly not 100%.
Hmm. Is that, that's a fresh water source? Is that something that folks in the area actually are utilizing with wells or something like that also?
Yes, well, they actually, you know, there is the great fact that Egypt produces an incredible amount of crops, which ancient Egypt did too. All ancient Egypt was just a thin strip of green land that was around a river. That's all the civilization was. But they grew everything because the river is so rich of nutrients and minerals. For plants and stuff. So people today, there's only like at Giza 1 inch rainfall per year. In the south, Luxor, Aswan, there's 0 inches of rainfall per year. So how do they irrigate their farm? They do it with canals, and they pump from the canals. So they're constantly pumping water into their fields today. They still use that technique in agriculture and irrigation today in Egypt, from the Nile, from canals, from the fresh water of the Nile. One of the, well, of course, the mother of rivers, considered the largest river, the greatest river in the world. It can be disputed. Some people say the Amazon is larger, but certainly that river today is functioning as it was for tens of thousands of years, the lifeblood of the civilization.
Yeah, if you look at a map, you see it clearly to this day, the green strip following the Nile all the way down to Aswan, pretty much. And then what is that other source? Where is it speculated that the source is coming from? Because it's... you know, Upper Egypt is below, and you know, it's the reverse there happening, right? So
yes, the Nile River flows from south to north. It's one of the only rivers in the world that does.
Yeah.
So the source of the Nile is in the south. It is in the mountains of near Khartoum. Actually, comes down to what's called where the Blue Nile meets the White Nile in Ethiopia, south of Ethiopia. Khartoum is one of the great cities where the Nile comes together. So it comes out of the mountain. There was a movie that was made out of a book written by a great Sir Richard Burton called Mountains of the Moon. We actually went and tried to find the source of the Nile. So it's actually in the mountains, African mountains of Ethiopia. It comes down at the Blue Nile, meets with the White Nile, and forms the Nile as she is today.
Wow, interesting. Yeah, you have Aswan there at the tip, and then you have Abu Simbel, Wadi Hafa, and then the river continues all the way to Dongola and Marawi as well. It goes for a long, long way there.
To Sudan, it goes all the way down, from down to Nubia, to Sudan, and to Ethiopia, and to what is Khartoum, is the major city.
Wow. Do you think, Stephen, that the site of Saqqara could actually be connected with Giza with underground passageways? Is it possible that it stretches in those distances?
Well, this is the important thing of our work, and it continues to prove this. Again, in my book, Land of Osiris, was published in 2001, we speculated that it was just one... Again, Hakim, who presented this to me, Abdel Hakim Awyan was his name. He was passed away in 2008 at the age of 82. He was the senior tour guide in Egypt from 1952 through 2008. He still had an active tour guide license. He was the senior tour guide. He was an indigenous wisdom keeper, a master of the oral traditions of his country. He proposed to me and my research partner in the 90s that, of course, first, the country wasn't called Egypt. Egypt's a Greek name. It was called Kemet or Kemet, which meant the black land, the rich soil that the Nile deposits. And even the ancient Nile was the same way. And he would tell us that there was an older river, that what is today Western Desert was the original Nile. And the civilization was based from that river. And so what he said in the term of Kemet being the name of the civilization that the ancients called it, there was another area of sites which he called Bu Wizard. Bu, meaning land, Wizard, the original name for Osiris. We retranslated, it's the title of my first book, Land of Osiris. This is from Abu Ruwash in the north to Dashur in the south. It's 25 square miles. It goes from Abu Ruwash to Giza to Saqqara to Abu Sir Abu Judab to another site called Zawiyat al-Aryan to Dashur. Those are the sites. They are 25 square miles. All were characterized by having stone masonry pyramids on a grid line, a curved grid line, a Fibonacci spiral. And they were all connected by underground tunnels, bringing water to the sites. First, the tunnels came from the west, because I believe they carved straight through limestone bedrock, it's at least 50 miles out into the western desert, connected with the underground Nile River, brought that river to what is today the Nile Valley, to these tunnels, now then going north to south from Dashur to Abu Wash, and we believe it even may go further south than Dashur now. But this was the original site that he called the Land of Osiris. This site, the oldest site, has the oldest, it's got the Sphinx, the Great Pyramid, the Serapeum. These are the oldest sites that we can study, and they were constructed well over 10,000 years. So what we have now is what I said to you earlier. What we have now devised is an easy way to understand what we're discussing. We break it into just two simple parts, a civilization we call pre-cataclysmic and civilization we call post-cataclysmic. We label the cataclysm as happening around 12,000 years ago. It is what I call, and again, I can discuss this in great detail. There's two books I highly recommend if people are interested in this subject. One is called Cataclysm 9500 BC, written by two British scientists, Allen and Dallaire.
Yes.
The book was published by my good friend, Barbara Handclough. She told me about the book and the work long before it came out. She then wrote a book called Catastrophobia in 2001 based on their book. She has re-edited the book, repoed it out in 2011 called Awakening the Planetary Mind. I highly recommend it. Barbara, along with Alan and Dallaire and myself, believe the source of the cataclysm is what is known as the Vela Supernova, capital V-E-L-A. People can Google it. It occurred probably around 14,000 to 11,000 years ago. It impacted our entire solar system, not just the Earth. It explains a lot of anomalies which are not able to be explained astronomically. Number one, Uranus in our solar system is totally on its side. It's totally off 90 degrees from its axis. What did it? Something knocked it on its side. And of course, we know the Earth herself is at a tilt of 23.5 degrees.
Yep.
It's what gives the Earth its particular wobble, which gives us precession and equinoxes and gives us our zodiac. Okay? We are stipulating here, Alan and Dallaire stipulated that before this Vela supernova, our Earth was straight up.
Hmm.
Was not on the tilt. It is the supernova which impacted our whole planet, brought down the civilizations we're talking about. It was the mass cataclysm. It is the source of the flood myth. And not only does the flood myth come from our Old Testament, from Chaldean or Babylonian sources, but there is a flood myth, a cataclysm myth, that exists in 250 indigenous peoples on our planet. It is something that's universal. And academia has attempted to explain this by saying that there was a local flood, a local event, around 4,000 BC in the Middle East, and that's supposedly the source of the biblical flood. But when we read the flood myth, even read the Greek myth, or even indigenous myth, they're talking about a worldwide cataclysm.
Yeah.
A worldwide event, not a local event. The only event that can match what we're talking about is this event that happened around 11,500 years ago. And so then, what we categorize then, if I just continue, Henry,
yeah.
What we can categorize then is what we talk about pre-cataclysm is Giza, is the Serapeum, these incredible technology, no inscriptions, no markings anywhere, no evidence anybody ever being buried in these sites or anything like that, no evidence of the dynastic people not coming until later and transforming the sites. So when we take people to the sites, our key theme is site transformation. And Yusuf Awiyan is an absolute master at this. Taking them, I can show you a box, which they will claim a sarcophagus, but there's no inscriptions on it, nothing to link it to any dynastic period. And it's perfect precision, 2/10,000 of an inch tolerance, perfect right angles. Then right next to it, we can show another box where something's been scribbled on. And we can say, oh, this is where the dynastic people came in and attempted to transform the site. And they put their glyphs on it. We can show from every period in Egyptian history, even going back from the Old Kingdom to the Middle Kingdom to the New Kingdom, ancient Egypt becomes an anomaly. It does not fit the normal pattern of what you would call Darwinian linear evolution, which
yep.
means things progress from the simple, from the primitive to the complex. Egypt is the reverse. You go back to the old, if you just look at the dynastic people, Old Kingdom, you have the most beautiful structures, the most beautiful glyphs, the most beautiful jewelry, the paintings, beautiful things. Then you go forward and it degenerates until you have what we call certain Renaissance periods. In the Middle Kingdom, there was the 12th dynasty. They attempted to emulate the Old Kingdom. So they tried to refine their work, go back to what was the Old Kingdom. Well, then we go to the New Kingdom. It then degenerates, but you have the 18th dynasty of the New Kingdom, and it's another Renaissance. They also want to go back to the Old Kingdom and go back to the older ways. But what do we see, Henrik? When we really observe the Old Kingdom, they too were trying to imitate and try to identify with the previous time period, which was the pre-cataclysmic ancient Kemet, which was before dynasty, which is over 10,000 years. And it's easy for us now to be able to show this at the sites. Every site we can take you to, we can show you pre-cataclysm and post-cataclysm. And we can point to site transformation that exists, started from the old kingdom, from the very beginning, the so-called dynastic period, all the way to the end, to the Roman period. We can show you Roman temples where they took rose quartz granite pillars out of ancient Cretan temples and put them in the Roman temple, where they used Cara marble, which was Romans were used for, but they used also Cretan marble, which is different and much older. So we can show that every culture that came into Egypt from 5,000 years ago attempted to transform the sites, tended to identify themselves with the ancient Cretans and make put their cultural identity on the stream, so that there is a stream that we can point to, continually transformation of the sites for at least 10,000 years.
Absolutely fascinating. I've not actually heard, despite being familiar with the Dallaire's work and Barbara Henkel, we talked about many times, but the Vela supernova, I have actually not heard about that before. That's very interesting. It places it right in that timeline, of course. Is that primarily why? Because of the timing of the supernova, or is there other things involved?
Yes, I think it is the timing and the effect. The fact that this, even the way there is a Greek myth that Alan and Dallaire use in their book, a myth of Phaeton, which the Greeks talked about, a dragon came out of the sky.
Yep.
Well, they're actually describing it, and it would have looked that way, that there would have been streaks of fire actually going across the sky because of this tremendous effect. I mean, I would estimate, Henrik, that maybe anywhere from 75 to 90% of all humanity perished. So we, speaking here today, are the ancestors of the 10% that survived. And this is why Barbara Clough, going to one of her favorites, Barbara also, I don't know if you've ever interviewed her, but she's great.
Oh, we have many times, yeah.
Yes, we have. But Barbara has a master's in psychology. I don't know if you're aware of that. And she was also a big fan of Emmanuel Velikovsky, who was a student of Freud. Emmanuel Velikovsky wrote two very significant books in the 50s, Ages in Collision and Worlds in Chaos, where he talked about perhaps Venus, explosion of Venus, but he talked about the fact that our solar system had been impacted and something, and he pointed to a supernova. He didn't identify it then, but it was he that put a lot of other people on it. There's many, many astrophysicists who have identified it. But it is in the current book, if you have not read it, Awakening the Planetary Mind, where she really pinpoints it at the Vela supernova.
Absolutely fascinating. So think about this. No zodiac before this time, before 11,500 years ago or so.
Yes, and I would tell people if they want to have a little discussion on this, again, my dear friend Brian Foster, who you've interviewed, and who we have been great close friends on Facebook for over 2 years, but had never met at JFK Airport for the first time, and had a wonderful time in Egypt together. I recommend this site for folks, www.hiddenincatours.com. HiddenIncaVideos.com. Ryan took a great series of videos there. He posted one where I'm actually having this discussion at the Zodiac at the Temple of Dendera on the wall, which is a copy. The original is in the basement of the Louvre. It was taken by Napoleon and the French. But even the copy shows it. What I show, I can tell you what I'm pointing to people, and they can go see the video. The great R.H. Rollo de Lubitsch, who was an Alsatian mathematician philosopher, who John Anthony West today, and I'm sure you probably have interviewed him, is the greatest proponent of the teachings of Schwaller. Schwaller was the first one to look at the zodiac and say that there was something strange about it, that it was pointing to the fact that, one, he said it was a copy of a much older zodiac, and something important was indicated in the zodiac. He, being a mathematician, of course, he worked on all sorts of angles, connections. The astrological science of Cancer has a very specific position in the zodiac at Dendera. It forms all sorts of different angles and connections to other things. And in studying that, Schwaller was convinced that the zodiac is saying, one, itself was based on a much older zodiac, and two, was saying that the zodiac started during the age of Cancer, which would be around 8,000 BCE. So Barbara believes this. I have believed this also. Again, I've done the research on it. There is no distinct evidence of any people practicing formal system of astronomy or astrology before 10,000 years.
Fascinating.
So therefore, we're saying to those people who are astrologers out there might be interested in this, that there never has been a complete full precession. If it started in Cancer, that means there was no age of Leo. There was no age before that. They calculate like it's been a full precession, like it's gone back 12. But if it started in the age of Cancer, that negates the theory that a lot of people have that the Sphinx represents the astrological time of Virgo.
Right.
With a woman's head and a lion's body. We absolutely dispute that. We could say who the Sphinx really represents, and the Sphinx was constructed, according to Abdel-Hakim, 54,000 years ago, long before there was any age of Virgo.
So who does the Sphinx represent?
The Sphinx represents the Great Mother. To the ancient Cumicians, who were matriarchal, they not exactly said feminine and masculine were equal. To these ancient people, the feminine was a little more superior. The feminine was the source of energy. So they used the characteristic of, we're not going to say goddess, because it's incorrect, because people understand these things as god or goddess. The term is nectar, usually spelled N-E-T-E-R. We put the E's in there because there were no signs for vowels. It's usually just the glyph for N-T-R, nectar. And it was translated from Champollion to Wallace Fudge of the British Museum as meaning god or goddess. So that's why everybody thinks the ancient Egyptians were polytheistic and worshipped hundreds of gods and goddesses. But it was R. Ishwala de Lubitsch, we return to him again, who first challenged the translation of nectar meaning deity. He said, no, it was an aspect of the whole, a principle, not the whole itself. Hakim took it even further and said it was a sense. He would tell us that we are innately born with 360 senses. 180 we label feminine, 180 we label masculine. And it's what's called circular consciousness. The circle represents that, no beginning, no end. So in essence, saying that when we're in the space of using all 360 senses, we are enlightened, we are until circular consciousness. And he said that, and then Hakim would say, and you know, we're only using 5 today. So he would always say to people, please excuse me, I'm not trying to insult anybody, but we are crippled today. We're only using 5. So therefore, there's 355 innate senses. And these senses became what we think are deities. They're aspects. So when I'm talking about Hathor, Horus, Osiris, Jehuti, these are principles. They are not deity. They were not originally understood to be the whole, God as we understand God, but to be an aspect of the whole. And there again, we have the concept of as above, so below. Above, within. You cannot have God without if you don't have God within. So the idea is these senses are within us. We activate these senses at the sites because each site is dedicated to a different sense, a different matter, a temple of Hathor, a temple of Osiris. Each one of those is supposed to activate that energy within you. That's the experience that people have at the site. That's why we labeled our tour the techno spiritual tour. We had Chris Dunn. We had the engineers with it to look at the spiritual aspect of the technical aspect of the engineering, but then being there, meditating, as Hakim would say, and Hakim was a master at teaching from both sides of the brain. He was the best I ever knew. I emulate him as best I can to try to have someone to think from both sides of the brain and have a total experience. Therefore, when you're there and you connect with the energy of Osiris at his temple at Abydos, at Isis at her temple at Philae, that energy activates within you, and that becomes the consciousness race. So the whole idea was that they were never considered deities to the very ancient people. They were principles, active principles of creation, and there are 360, and we're only using 5. So the whole idea of what Hakim called this time period that we're going into now, the whole reason we do these teachings, the whole reason he passed it to me and to others to spread to the West, is that we're going into the awakening now. We're coming out of a cycle of darkness where we're only stuck in 5 senses. More senses are opening up. It's what people call ESP, the sixth sense, all of these different things. Your intuitive, psychic. And I worked for the Rosicrucian Order as a staff research scientist. I actually tested people professionally known as that, but we never used the word psychic. We hated the term. Mm-hmm. We used the word sensitive because that's something that everyone can identify with. We're all sensitive to different degrees. So those that do it professionally, maybe they've got all 360. Nobody's doing a 360. As Hakim said, we were going to work on a third book, which is just going to stay in limbo now, re-identifying the titles of the letters. And he said he could probably identify 20 or 22. He was definitely operating a more sensitive than the normal human being. But no one has been operating 360 unless you could consider a Jesus, someone who was totally enlightened.
Very interesting. I had a lot of questions about what we just mentioned there, but let me back up to the Sphinx a little bit more. Do you think that there was at some point another face, head on the Sphinx, considering the discrepancy there in the size?
Yes, and you know what I did? And I realized I didn't finish it. She was, again, this matriarchal culture looked at everything that was created, everything that was uncreated, and they gave it the name Nut. She was that netter, the netter of creation and uncreation. N-U-T, Nut. That was the Great Mother. So the story is, when the Great Mother wanted to manifest in physical form on the earth, she spit. Where she spit was a Yardang outcropping of limestone, which is today the Sphinx. So they call her Tefnut, the spit of the Great Mother, the spit of Nut. And why, how came with the people there, why do you say spit? Well, he would always say, if you think about it, every time we expectorate, I'll use the formal term, there's no volume, there's no weight. It can't be measured. So it there's no volume and no weight to it, technically. So what they're basically saying is you cannot define the Great Mother. But if you want to, they made it a physical form. So this is why he dated her as the, and the indigenous oral tradition is, the Sphinx was the first thing created above ground, before any temples, before any pyramids. And she was carved, first cut, 54,000 years ago. And so she represents the spit of the Great Mother, an aspect of the Great Mother, and was always seen that way. There were attempts in later dynasties, particularly again in this 18th dynasty, as Egypt is becoming more patriarchal, more influenced by the patriarchal cultures around it, like Greece, like Rome, like Persia, that eventually, and of course, then like Judaism, it eventually becomes patriarchal with Islam, but and Christianity, then Islam. But it's becoming more matriarchal, so there was an attempt to masculinize the Sphinx in the 18th dynasty. So yes, I say the head of the Sphinx as it is today was recarved many times. We don't know how many times. But the head as it is today, I believe, was carved in the very early days of what the so-called dynastic period is by a gentleman who had a title Menha. The Greeks called him Menes. They said he was the first pharaoh. It's using the word pharaoh wrong. There were no male pharaohs. I can go with that if you'd like. But first, let's just say that Menha recarved the head of the Sphinx to honor his mother, who was a black African woman named Nikhotep, and that's who the Sphinx is today. The face of the Sphinx has never been a male face. It is not a man's face. It is a woman's face, and it is clearly a black African woman's face, but it is not original. If you look at the head, you understand that these people were masters of harmony and proportion. You look at the head of the Sphinx today, and she's totally out of proportion with the body.
Yeah.
So it has been recarved back many times, and the erosion on the head of the Sphinx is different than the head of the body that can prove that. So the head of the Sphinx today is a woman's head. It is a woman's face, like it's always supposed to have been, but it's not original. The original head of the Sphinx would be like, if people know some of the netters that we're talking about, the so-called goddesses, Sekhmet or Mut or Tefnut herself, if you've ever seen a depiction, anybody can Google that. It's usually a lioness human face combination.
Yeah, that's right.
Like Sekhmet. That was the original face.
Tell us the age again. Did I hear 54,000 years ago?
Hakim claimed, using a rough estimate of 54,000 years, he claimed that when the sun rises today, it's 20 degrees off than what it would have been before. So he uses 10 degrees to represent precessional age. 26 times 2 is roughly 52. So he uses an estimate of 54,000 years. When it was first carved, because it is not facing where she originally was facing. She would have been facing the cyclical rising of Sirius. When the Sphinx was originally carved, she was exactly facing Sirius when it rose at the end of July. So if someone could come up with a computer program, but it, you know, here's the point where we've had a lot of people working with computer programs. The fact, again, happens with this cataclysm that the Earth over 10,000 years, the sky is very different. This is why I'm not a fan of the field which is known as archaeoastronomy,
right,
which a lot of people are liking to identify, and this will go back to my point we've discussed before, certain sites with different constellations. It works only post-cataclysm. As Barbara Clow has mentioned, as I say also, after the cataclysmic event, which is why she originally termed her book Catastrophobia, she said those 10% or whoever that survived the cataclysm carried a phobia, carried a fear of cataclysm, and that has pervaded our civilizations ever since. Therefore, they had to invent astronomy and astrology to watch the skies, to predict solstices, equinoxes, and be able to know if another invader was coming. So therefore, I say any site that is oriented to solstices, equinoxes, and to constellations is post-cataclysmic. And I say the sites like Giza, like Saqqara, like Abusir, are pre-cataclysmic and are not oriented to any constellation. So the first thing that Hakim always told us, when the Great Pyramid was aligned, the only astronomical point was what was the pole star. And he said the pole star, when the Great Pyramid was aligned, was Polaris. Polaris is about to become a pole star again. So if you go back again, a precessional year, which the dynastic Egyptians called a great year, 26,000 years approximately, that would have been when the Great Pyramid was aligned.
Very interesting. I want to ask you more about this. The zodiac, you know, as some prominent psychologists has pointed out, Jung and Freud, kind of shows that the zodiac is part of the archetypal energies of mankind, pretty much, that the Greek gods is a reflection of these powerful principles within the human psyche. But again, if we, you know, go back to this point, if this only is about 10,000 years ago or so, then that means that this event, the catastrophe, had a massive impact on our consciousness and probably transformed it in a way that it's changed so much potentially, Stephen, that we don't even know what it was like before that time to be alive as a human being.
Again, exactly right. And again, it was Emanuel Velikovsky, to his credit, who first looked at that, who first looked at the of what we call the modern civilization, the last 10,000 years, at least the last 5 to 8 thousand years of recorded of history of evidence of civilization. He claimed it was obvious that there was a phobia, that humans were operating with a fear, a collective fear. Again, he was a Freudian, of course, so he psychoanalyzed humanity. And Barbara, being a student of Velikovsky, took up on that, saying that it is obvious, and it seems that way, that human behavior in the last 8,000 years has definitely oriented that way, to try to predict, to try to be secure, something, you know, to have a little fear in our background. And it is a universal fact, as we've seen in the last couple of years, whenever there is a catastrophe, a cataclysm around the world, like Fukushima, like the tsunami, everybody reacts. Everybody feels something. We want to, everybody's willing then, even if they're poor, to donate to Red Cross, they want to do something. Everybody wanted to rush down to Katrina in New Orleans to help the people. There is that universal fact that we all react to a cataclysm with wanting to help, with that, oh my God, it's terrible. We have that collective fear.
Yeah, I agree. Exactly. There's something there. Is there any way that we can try to begin to understand what the level of consciousness was before this? And I mean, again, we can talk about the 360 aspect that you mentioned, but it feels to me, and evidence seems to be suggesting, that we've been capped in some way. We've been cut off, if you will, a little bit. We've been like desensitized almost, and we're not as sensitive anymore, correct?
I agree. And it does come down to the basis of what is chematology, which is what we call the cycles, the five stages of the sun, which Hakim presented to us. The sun moving through five stages during the day represents stages of our developing consciousness and stages in prehistory. So it goes from Kheper, which is the dawn, Ra, which is noon, Un, which is the sun in early afternoon, Aten, which is the sun in the highest state of afternoon, Amun, which is night. And they also represent stages in prehistory. So the fact is, when we're talking about before the cataclysm, pre-cataclysm, we were in the age of Aten, the highest stage of consciousness, where we were using all 360 senses, where we could build pyramids and carve sphinxes and do what we did and have this incredible system of free energy. We're not there today. We're five, using maybe six, seven, some of us using eight, maybe eight, nine senses. But we're not there, but we can have an inkling to it. Those of us that had the spiritual experiences, those of us that had those moments which some masters like Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, like others have said, call it unity consciousness. That moment that some people can have during meditation, sometimes during spiritual practices, where you feel one with everything. You feel no borders, no boundaries to your body. Some people have had that experience under psychoactive drugs. I have. But basically, it's best to have it without any kind of extra stimulus. And you have that unity feeling. We can only have it briefly in this third dimension, which we are now, and still coming out of the age of Amun. But Amun is ended. This is why Hakim called where we are now the awakening. It is the dawn, the new Kheper, the new beetle, the scarab beetle is the symbol of our work. People are awakening. And so we're getting hints where it could be. This whole movement in the world, Henrik, of going to free energy.
Yeah.
Which is only going to increase. And much more from your land of the woods. Scandinavia is doing much more in this field than the U.S. and other countries are with free energy, with working with solar, with wind, with geothermal, et cetera, et cetera. This is the future. And again, we are just rediscovering what we already knew. This is what it will be. I once gave a lecture to people in front of a couple hundred people in the audience where I said, what is going to characterize this awakening is you're going to wake up in the middle of the night and know something that you did not know before. And I looked out in the audience and I saw a woman elbowing her friend, giving it to her, like, see what he's saying? People are experiencing this. I'm sure you get it from people who call you up, who people who respond to the guests you have, say, oh, thank you for this guest. It really opened up something in me. Blah, blah, blah. All of that is what, all of what you're doing, all of what I'm doing are part of the awakening. We're here now to try to bring back this consciousness, the awakening. So it is. But to say, could we remember what it was to be in 360? Only a Jesus, only a Moses, only a Muhammad, only a Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, only those that claim that they're enlightened could even have the greatest hint of what it is. But I see inklings of it all the time, Henrik, where I see, and to me, the future, of course, is in the youth. You know, we've done our part. We're now the teachers. I've now moved into the elder status, and we're now working for the young to come along. But I see the youth now thinking more holistically. This is why gay marriage has gone over in the United States. Why no longer? Because young people, the same thing with something like doing away with prohibition of marijuana. These things may not seem to be related, but they are bringing this. This is the sign of the awakening, that people now, especially the younger people in all different countries, are thinking globally. They're not thinking borders. They're not thinking nationalistically. They're love of their country, but they're thinking now we are a human race. We are a human tribe. And this is coming to what, this is the sign of what is predicted is going to happen. But this type of consciousness comes in little by little. It's going to take a while, but we're on that path. And what Hakim left this plane supremely convinced that this was going to happen. Nothing could stop the dawn. Nothing's going to stop the change in the cycle. The powers that be, what sometimes people call the global elite, are trying to hold on desperately to their little power bases. This is why the world is exploding today. All countries. I mean, I just go on the news today in Brazil, in Turkey. Now Egypt is exploding again. I mean, countries all around the world are saying enough is enough. This is a world planet. We're a world people. It should be for all of us. And so this is the sign we see, and that the senses are opening, that we are heading back in that direction.
All right. Well, let's take a short break here, Stephen. We're going to continue talking more in the second, of course. But please give us your website, or if there's several websites, if you want to get out. And I want you to talk about your book titles as well, and if there's something you obviously recommend for newcomers to work. And then are you working on something new in terms of book format as well, Stephen?
I think not. Like I said, when Hakim was still alive, we were working on a third book. My two books that I wrote with him are The Land of Osiris, published in 2001, Adventures Unlimited Press. Second book is called From Light into Darkness, The Evolution of Religion in Ancient Egypt, which was published 2005 by Adventures Unlimited Press. But along the way, when we were working on retranslating the narratives, he stopped. And he said to me, you know, we're just doing what the Greeks were doing. So I'm going to leave it perhaps to his son, Yusuf Arian, to write the next book. But the website that people should look for is the Kemet School of Ancient Mysticism, www.kemetology.com. That has all the tours listed that we're going to be doing another tour next April. It has all the work about Hakim on there. My books are listed on there. And as well as Brian Foster's website, www.hiddeninkatours.com.
Kemetology. .com as well. We're going to have this linked up on the website, of course, so people can click through easily from there. And check out the books as well, of course, because there's much more material in there. But we'll carry on in the second hour in a little bit, so stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back.
Still a child. So